So what's the big problem with wealth creation? How do people like us, who didn't inherit a boatload of money, who are investing and building wealth from our own blood, sweat, and tears, how do we invest in a way that gives us remarkable results and become financially free before retirement age? I don't know about you, but I am sick of hearing from wealth gurus and experts who don't walk their own talk and prescribe strategies that are a one-size-fits-all approach. For self-made people like you and me, I'm here to tell you that you don't need to be superhuman or already wealthy to reach financial freedom earlier than 65. This is the Alternative Investing Podcast. Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast. In today's episode, I want to kind of create an extension of a concept that I've spoken about before, which is the velocity of money. But I want to revisit this because I believe that in the environment that we are sitting at today, this concept of velocity has more kind of relevance and should be treated with a lot more caution than in past cycles where perhaps we're in a boom cycle. So my thesis is in essence that investors who consistently and mindfully do apply that concept of velocity of money actually achieve exponentially better results. Emphasis on the word consistently and mindfully. In other words, you know, velocity does drive the wealth that you create. And the metaphor I'd love to use is this idea of you don't just buy a car and sit it in the driveway. You know, that's, you know, applying zero velocity, if you like, and not really making the most of the car and the purpose of the car, which is to get around. However, the way of driving a car where you just gradually get faster and faster and faster, or you maintain a very high speed, is also highly dangerous, particularly if you're not taking into consideration the road and the weather conditions. And in many cases, this kind of driving can result in catastrophe, particularly as you go through treacherous mountains and storms and lightning and thunder and things like that. So if we then kind of have that metaphor in mind when we're thinking about the velocity of money, and I'd love to start today is kind of just giving you a quick reminder of what velocity of money is and how to apply it. Because, you know, I think intuitively we all kind of know what velocity means. And so velocity of money, which is really applying speed or movement to money, but I want to just give that a little bit more bones so that we're all starting from the same place. Economically, when we talk about velocity of money, economists use it as a measure of health for an economy. So it's really a reference to how many times a single dollar actually changes hands. And, you know, if the velocity of money in an economy is very high, meaning the same dollar is changing hands many times, it means people are spending, it means they're happy, it means sentiment is good, it means the market conditions are likely to kind of are intertwined, and it's usually referenced to a rising market. The second part of this is, you know, how does that velocity then show up in business? And, you know, a lot of people misunderstand that a business isn't in the job, in the business of selling widgets. A business's goal is to sell goods or services as fast as they can, to not have stocks sitting on shelves. And they are in the business of trying to speed up the velocity of their money and the velocity in which they earn money and profits. In the banking sector, this concept of velocity is absolutely fundamental to their business. And it's why, to some degree, the exponential returns that banks earn can be understood when thinking about the concept of velocity. So they tell us, banks and other large institutions say to us, we should be savers. We should put our money into their vaults and allow them to look after it for us. In the meantime, they take the polar opposite action to the advice that they give. So what they do is, you know, they lend out our dollars over and over again. So it's very commonly misunderstood that the way that banks make money is not by taking the dollar that I've put in the bank and lending it to someone else and getting a certain rate of interest. It's way bigger than that. They're trying to take my dollar and simultaneously lend it out to as many people as they possibly can. And in some cases, my dollar might go out to 9 borrowers followers at the same time. So they're9x-ing the interest on that single dollar, and then multiply that by all the dollars in the bank, and you start to see why it's the banks that never lose. I think from an investor point of view, it's about creating movement and gaining multiple uses of every dollar that we invest. Now, sometimes it's easy to do this, sometimes it's more challenging, but moving money and its use is what creates those benefits and reduces our exposure to losses such as inflation and market fluctuations. I guess the extension of this that I really want to drive home today is that velocity of money as an investor really comes from two things. Number one, it's the thinking that you bring to your money and wealth, and the second part is the actions that you take. So it's not just about mindlessly trying to move your money around. It's about strategic thinking about what happens, what are the implications of moving your money from one place to another. Now, I'm not talking about trading assets here. I'm talking about how you may, for example, put money to work quickly when it comes into your world, instead of just allowing it to accumulate. I'm talking about how you can access profits in assets and put them to use without liquidating assets. So velocity can be used in a lot of different ways inside of investing, but it's about recognizing what is and isn't in alignment with your objectives and your risk profile. So that kind of leads me to something that I haven't spoken about before, which is this tension between velocity and risk. Now, there's no question no velocity versus lots of velocity can make a huge difference in where you end up from a wealth perspective. People who don't apply a lot of velocity for whatever reason, maybe they feel fear, maybe they feel they don't have all the information, maybe they suffer analysis paralysis, but people who apply no velocity, if you look at where their wealth building goes over a lifetime of working, often they end up really falling short of where they'd like to be. And often, given whatever level of income they have, they've sort of robbed themselves to some degree. The other extreme is people who just live on the very edge. And entrepreneurs are particularly guilty of this, where, you know, they make a bunch of money and then they reinvest instead of taking a little bit of money off the table. So their velocity of money is incredibly high, and they're incredibly leveraged, and they're really just pushing to the limit. Anyone who's read the Richard Branson book, Losing My Virginity, would recognize that he's probably one of those characters. Certainly as he's aged and lived through multiple market cycles, that's probably tempered a little bit. But he certainly has had a reputation for, you know, taking profits and then betting it all on the next endeavor or project. I think, you know, one of the things I'll just quickly remind everyone of as well is that, you know, there are three stages to building wealth, and it's really important to understand this in reference to how you might apply velocity. So the first stage of wealth building is you need to build capital. You need to multiply your dollars, leverage your dollars to grow your net worth, your capital, as quickly as possible. And so that may or may not involve the use of leverage, but essentially what you are doing is potentially taking a dollar and trying to multiply it as quickly as possible. Now, by doing that, essentially what you do is you give yourself the ability to create a resource for yourself that you can then decide, well, what do I do next? The best example of this is, you know, the straight buy and hold property investment strategy, where you buy, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 properties and you allow it to grow for a period of time and exponentially increase your net worth, in contrast to where you would have been if you just saved that money in a bank account. Now, the second stage of wealth building is really about then taking that capital, and typically most asset classes, bar alternative investments, don't offer a great yield or income stream. So then it becomes a case of, well, how do I take the capital that I've got and crank up the income? How do I take the capital that I have and even just take a small portion out of it and get it to work slightly harder for me from an income production perspective? The third stage of wealth building is about starting to think about how to build those annuities, those infinite income streams. And so within the context of those three stages of wealth building, and certainly I encourage anyone who's interested in understanding more about the nuances of that to go back to the podcast where I talk about those three stages in more detail. But in reference to velocity, it's really important to recognize, and Richard Branson, the guy I just mentioned, is probably a great example of this. In his younger years, there was probably an intuitive recognition that if he wanted to reach the goals that he had, he needed to apply massive velocity to business building and wealth building. In fact, I would have said for him, wealth building was probably secondary. He, from what I've read and what I've heard, loves the game of building business. And so for him to build the empire of businesses and wealth that he wanted, he had to apply high velocity. He had to take big risks with his capital and his money in order to get to the next level. And I understand that, you know, as a younger investor, as a newer investor, there's an inclination to kind of say, well, I want to take bigger risks because I know I've got time on my side. I want to get somewhere quickly. So, and then, you know, as you move into that second and third phase, it's often common that the desire to push velocity to its limit starts to, you know, pull back. And, you know, instead of focusing on how do I grow my money, the focus switches gradually to more how do I preserve my capital and get a consistent, sustainable rate of return that I can live with. And, you know, so depending on where you are on your wealth journey will also tie into how much velocity you want to apply. And say, for example, a lot of the clients that I'm working with, they've kind of made a reasonable pile of capital for them to then start investing in higher income returning assets. So they're less interested in trying to maximize leverage and maximize velocity. And like myself, they're more interested in preservation. But, you know, certainly if I think about my own journey, when I first started, I was absolutely fascinated with the concept of velocity. And I was fortunate enough to grow up in an era when it didn't really matter so much what your income was. It was mainly about whether you as an investor felt you could carry an investment property from a cash flow point of view and whether or not you could pull together the capital for the deposit. So it was a bit more like self-management. And that's why a lot of investors who started around the time that I did have accumulated massive property portfolios because they could. Now, that doesn't necessarily apply in today's environment, but what I would say is that using leverage to accumulate, say, for example, a property portfolio certainly makes sense as a starting point. But what doesn't make sense, I don't believe, in this market is in the event that the banking sector turned around and went back to those sorts of conditions where they were lending freely, the idea of, you know, buying a property, waiting for it to go up, refinancing and going again and building a huge portfolio of properties, each which has a teeny tiny bit of equity in it, it doesn't make sense to me. It's a super high risk strategy. And I'll tell you a story about a fellow that I met when I was starting to study more strategy around wealth building. And he was a lovely guy. He had recently divorced. And I remember the group dynamic when that program or that course started, there was only about seven or eight of us in the room. It was very kind of professional in a way. And then I remember sharing a story of loss in, you know, from my point of view, what something that had happened to me. And it just kind of opened the floodgates around the room. And his story was essentially that he had done exactly that. He had bought a property, waited for the value to go up a little, refinanced, and then bought the next property and done it again and again and again. He'd forayed into some small-scale developments and had done the same thing. And just prior to the year that we were in, he had a massive property portfolio worth about $15 million. And one of the banks on one of the properties had become a little nervous about the environment and had actually called in part of his loan, had asked him to increase his capital contribution to that particular loan. And he just didn't have the means to do it. And it basically fell like a row of dominoes. It was tragic. He lost his entire portfolio. He went from having, I think it was at least a couple of dozen properties to zero. That put enormous financial stress on the relationship, the household. He ended up separating from his wife and, you know, financial devastation just was probably going to hang over his head for at least another few years. So, you know, that is a story of someone who understood the concept of velocity, but probably misused it, and as well kind of misjudged the environment and the weather conditions in the environment. So I think the point here is you can't keep blindly investing and increasing velocity or maintaining high velocity without tuning into your environment. The other thing that I want to kind of revisit is this idea of high income and its relationship to velocity. I've actually observed in many situations, high income earners actually, in fact, apply less velocity. And it's almost this lackadaisical view that tomorrow, I'll get to it tomorrow, or no, I have a financial planner who's doing it for me, so I've abdicated. And society assumes that if you have a high income, that it automatically leads to being wealthy, and it certainly has the outward appearance of it, whether it be fancy houses, cars, and holidays, or just lavish spending. But the more people that I speak to about wealth and wealth building, I observe this to be completely unfounded. And I think it's really important to recognize the gift of having a high income gives you the ability to fuel and convert more of that income into wealth sooner. The problem, though, is that when you have a high income, it's often easy to behave as if you have all the time in the world, and high income often leads a lot of people to feel that they have earned the right to a luxurious lifestyle. And this idea of velocity, which in essence is tied up with the idea that there's, you know, limited time and that there's importance to bring a bit of heat and urgency to your wealth building, kind of falls away a little bit. So just because you have a high income doesn't necessarily mean that you will properly apply velocity. And similarly, just because you have a low income doesn't mean you don't have the right to consider velocity when you're thinking about your wealth building. And certainly some of you who know me well understand that in my own journey, I've always had relatively mediocre income, but I've had huge emphasis on the mindful application of velocity. And ultimately, I believe that is more impactful than just a high income by itself. I've certainly met a lot of clients over the years, and there's a guy whom I will call Mo, who was someone who had a very high income consistently over, I'm going to say, at least four decades, and found themselves in a position where they were ratcheting up their lifestyle. This fellow and his wife certainly had some very lavish holidays, lived in a beautiful home, drove always the latest and greatest cars, and always thought that there would be time to think about wealth. He certainly wanted to participate in lucrative investment deals, and he had, because of the circles that he moved in, plenty of invitations to join in on, you know, lucrative investments. But he was very disorganized, and he would agonize about the most minor details. He would say things like, oh, the transaction fees are too high, or the solicitor charged me too much for advice. Or probably the most common thing I heard was, the market will be better in the future. And the result in his life is that he's ended up with a net worth which is significantly less than where he thought he would be. He thought simply by earning a high income that the wealth would work itself out, and he's found himself in a situation where it simply hasn't. So in terms of really driving home where I think the key takeaways are from this episode and potentially the exercises that I think would be really valuable for you guys is, number one, we're in an environment right now which has a high degree of uncertainty. There's not a huge amount of blood in the water as yet, but I think there's a high probability of some pain economically, which may or may not result in a severe or diabolical recession, but we simply don't know. We don't know where the environment is going to take us. So right now, slowing your decision-making down, being more mindful is really, really important. And that is different, I might add, to sticking your head in the sand. Sticking your head in the sand is not a I guess, a strategy for coping with uncertainty. Neither is making impulsive decisions based on fear. So there's certainly a lot of those two latter points going on in the environment right now, people sticking their head in the sand or making impulsive decisions based on fear. So that's the first key. Slow your decision-making down, be more mindful. The second thing I would say is the mental pivot that I think a lot of investors have to make if they want to succeed over the next 5 to 10 years is a pivot to independent thinking. Now, even understanding the concept of velocity and recognizing that if you mindfully apply it, it will have a huge impact will set you apart from 99.9% of other investors. But it's obviously easier said than done. And the best example of this is intellectually, many investors understand this idea that when there is a downturn, when there is an economic downturn, when there is a recession, when there is blood in the water, there are more opportunities presenting themselves than at any other point in the cycle. The problem is we're so busy worrying about a doomsday scenario that a lot of people fail to take action, or people find themselves in a situation where they're not prepared. And so opportunities just fly on by and they just don't have themselves, they don't have their ducks in a row, they don't have their finances in order and their loans in order to take any action. And I've certainly seen plenty of that in the past as well. So if you want to understand this, this mental pivot to independent thinking is recognize that when there is a lot of panic and fear in the market, as is starting to happen right now, you need to get your house in order so that as opportunities present themselves, you'll at least have the option of taking action. And that is a really big mental pivot. The third and final piece around this concept of velocity is increase your velocity of thinking. Now, part of this is around recognizing that you have to make a decision about whether you are an investor or a trader. And, you know, certainly there are a lot of people who've been congratulating themselves about being great investors because they've been flipping real estate or they've traded shares or they've, traded Bitcoin or whatever the asset class is. However, as we move into this very uncertain environment, we need to remind ourselves that we are playing the long game. And so there's nothing wrong with trading as long as we recognize that's exactly what we're doing and that there is an element of speculation. And me personally, as we move into more difficult times, I am consciously moving away from speculative investments and focusing more on investment grade deals where there is high predictability of either movement in a certain direction or an outcome, or I'm focused on investments where I'm reminding myself that I'm playing the long game. And a really good example of this is I'm midstream on a small development right now. Everything that could go wrong has gone wrong, and timing and, you know, supply chain issues and various other market conditions has meant that a lot of the profit that was in the deal has probably been eroded. And the peace of mind that I have about this project is a reminder that I'm playing the long game. I'm not trying to flip these assets at the end of this project. I am holding them for the long term. I'm adding them to the portfolio. So even if I end up building at market value, let's say the cost of construction and the land and everything just means that when I finish, the profit's gone, but, you know, it's worth what it's worth, I'm not going to die in a ditch over it. So I think it's really important to, you know, reframe your thinking, and increasing the velocity of your thinking means that capacity to look forward and see the implications of different courses of action before you actually take it. So guys, that's kind of where I want to leave it today. If you are in a situation where you are highly levered, you have a lot of debt, this is a really good time to be evaluating your portfolio, de-risking where you can, reorganize your assets so that you have less exposure to any future volatility, and put yourself in a position where you are, number one, you've adapted to the market conditions and you're putting yourself in the position where as you start to recognize stellar opportunities, you can apply a little velocity to get yourself ahead of the curve. Till next time, guys, take care. And as always, please keep those questions coming through. I'm really enjoying those and I can't wait to catch up with you guys next time.
You've been listening to the Alternative Investing Podcast. If you're feeling frustrated that despite doing everything right in the property investing playbook and you're no closer to financial freedom, then head on over to IncosiWealth.com to learn more about how you can use alternative investments to catapult your investing income and blend strategies to shave decades off your timeline to financial freedom. See you on the next episode.